Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Speaking before the American Medical Association in Chicago yesterday, President Obama had this stark warning for the country.
If we do not fix our health care system, America may go the way of GM. Paying more, getting less, and going broke.
Inaction, the president said, is not an option. The time is now. But can a vast and vastly expensive health care overhaul make it through the gauntlet of competing interests in Washington? What compromises will the president accept? What compromises has he already made? This hour on Point, President Obama's big health care push and who is left behind? You can join the conversation. Do you agree with the president that health care reform is a national necessity? Do you think it is achievable? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Julie Rovner, health policy correspondent for National Public Radio. Julie, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So one writer called yesterday's healthcare speech Obama's Reagan in Berlin moment. How would you say the president's message played?
Well, it was a tough room, although he got a pretty warm reception, though I was reminding people that Hillary Clinton also got a standing ovation from the AMA, so you can't judge too much from the reception, although people were then reminding me that he got a warmer reception, indeed, than Hillary Clinton did when she went before the AMA in 1993.
Hey, what about beyond the AMA?
Beyond the AMA, you know, I think that, most of the people who, most of the groups that were definitely opposing efforts to overhaul the healthcare system in 1993 are still at the table. I think over the last few days, since we've started to see some of the details of the plans, you're starting to see some of the sharp knives coming out. Now that, you know, there's really mandates on the table, you're starting to see business saying, uh-oh, we don't really want to see, you know, business required to pay for its workers. And you're starting to see, indeed, the AMA last week, when there was talk of a public plan, we don't want to see a public plan that would pay Medicare rates. That would be very, very bad. So these groups that have really these intense opposition to certain parts of this overhaul are starting to express some of their serious doubts.
Let's get to some of those sharp knives,
yeah.
Julie. And to the centerpiece of this discussion seems to be controlling or reducing costs. How you pay for all this? What is the cost of the plan that the president is promoting?
Well, the president, of course, isn't promoting a specific plan, which is part of the amorphousness of what's going on. The plans are being developed in Congress. There are five different committees that are going to have something to say about this. At this point, we only have one plan on paper. That would be from the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which will start its official markup tomorrow. So the Congressional Budget Office, yet late yesterday afternoon, came out with a partial estimate, and they cautioned this is only partial, that says it would cost about $1 trillion. Now, it should be cautioned that $1 trillion does not include any of the cost of perhaps expanding the Medicaid and CHIP programs for low-income children. Medicaid program, of course, for the poor, and CHIP for moderate-income children, mm-hmm. Which would certainly add to that. Now, Republicans are already complaining loudly that, wow, it's $1 trillion. It would only cover 16 million of the uninsured. But, of course, when you add what's likely to be expansions to Medicaid and CHIP, that 16 million will go up a lot, so will the price tag. Mm.
Well, talk about the price tag here. $1 trillion, the president promised that health care reform will not increase the deficit.
Even if we accept all of the economic and moral reasons for providing affordable coverage to all Americans, there's no denying that expanding coverage will come at a cost, at least in the short run. But it is a cost that will not, I repeat, will not add to our deficits. I've set down a rule for my staff, for my team, and I've said this to Congress. Healthcare reform must be and will be deficit neutral in the next decade.
Deficit neutral. Julie Rovner, with already soaring deficits. Is it possible a plan of this magnitude will happen without additional borrowing, or dare we say increase in taxes?
It's possible it will happen without additional borrowing. It's not possible that it will happen without an increase in taxes. That's mm-hmm. the whole point. Mm-hmm. There's two ways to make it deficit neutral. You can cut spending or you can raise taxes. Now, the difficulty, of course, for the president is that he's got this campaign promise that says he will not raise taxes for anyone who earns less than $250,000. That's got him a little bit hamstrung. Congress has made no such promise. So Congress has a little bit more to work with. Now, there's all kinds of pay-fors on the table. Obviously, on the one hand, there's money to be moved around within the $2 trillion that we spend every year on health care. And the president has indeed put on the table, I think we're up to now about $600 billion in nips and tucks and cuts to Medicare, the Medicare and Medicaid programs, things that could be saved, perhaps. If you cover everyone, then hospitals, for instance, might not need a lot of the extra payments that they get now to cover people who are uninsured. Those people will have insurance, so therefore hospitals will be providing much less what we call uncompensated care. That could be money that could be then, you know, filtered back through the system. So you could get a chunk of money that way by savings for payments that are being made now. Mm-hmm. But there will certainly have to be a tax element to this also. Congress is talking about things like raising the tax on alcohol. Those taxes have not been raised in quite a while. There's talk of a tax on sugary soft drinks, mm-hmm. Perhaps, mm-hmm. A twofer, address the obesity problem and get a little bit of a tax to help pay for health care, although there's an awful lot of members from states that grow corn, and remember, those sugary soft drinks are not sweetened mostly with sugar. They're sweetened with corn syrup. Mm. So that could be politically difficult. Then, of course, there's this huge difficulty of, is there a possibility of taxing health benefits, expensive health benefits, something that the president beat up his opponent John McCain on?
Yeah.
Exactly. On the campaign trail. On the other hand, it is a huge, huge pot of money. It is not taxing health benefits. It's the largest expenditure that the federal government makes every year on health care after Medicare.
Well, so, the cost of health care, it is a serious problem. And the president, here he is yesterday, saying that it must be addressed.
Make no mistake, the cost of our health care is a threat to our economy. It's an escalating burden on our families and businesses. It's a ticking time bomb for the federal budget, and it is unsustainable for the United States of America.
And Julie Ravner, President Obama's timeline, he wants it done quickly.
Yes, he does. The timeline is to right now get it through the committee, or at least get it through the Senate committees before the July 4th recess, to get it through the House and Senate floor before the August recess, and to get it through House and Senate conference and to his desk by October. That is incredibly ambitious for something that everyone points out is going to restructure 1/6 of the federal economy. So that's really, really, really hard. Can they do it? I don't know. They're certainly going to try, but it's already, a little bit behind. But there's still, as I mentioned, the Senate Help Committee starts its markup tomorrow. The Senate Finance Committee is projected to start its markup early next week. So far, they're on schedule.
Julie Ravner, hold on a moment. Much more to get to with you. But at the moment, I'd like to bring in from Waltham, Massachusetts, Stuart Altman. He's a professor of national health policy at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. He served as a top advisor on health care for Presidents Nixon and Clinton and for Barack Obama's presidential campaign. Stuart Altman, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Nice to have you. You've been thinking about health care reform for years. You worked on this issue with candidate Obama. Give us a sense of what this president wants when it comes to health care reform.
Well, I think Julie laid it out beautifully. I mean, the issues that he's now going to have to grapple with are the ones that ultimately submarined the previous bills that overwhelmingly Americans want everyone covered. Overwhelmingly Americans would love to be able to pay less for their health care. The problem is that when you get down to the details, they're going to be winners and losers, mm-hmm. and the losers don't want to lose. So that's one side of the issue. But what's gotten much worse, and really what was really unsaid yesterday by the president, but which is really on his mind, is the entitlements, and particularly the Medicare entitlements, that are going to drown the federal budget if we don't do something about it in 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the debate over health care reform and trying to find savings, I view as a down payment on a much bigger debate, and that's what, and that is, can we continue to provide the level of care and the level of payment for our Medicare recipients?
Is that the biggest vulnerability that you hear in the proposal in his speech yesterday, Stuart Allman?
Yes, there's no question about it, and these are baby steps compared to the Medicare debate. But he is being advised, particularly by Peter Orszag, who's the head of the Office of Management and Budget, daily about how serious that problem is. And therefore, President Obama is taking on an issue that traditionally Democrats have shied away from. Traditionally, Democrats have made health care coverage far more important than controlling costs or finding the money. But if you listen to the president and you read what he says, at least they're at the same level. And actually, if I listen to his rhetoric, he's now made controlling spending even more important.
And the timeline that Julie Rovner made reference to, that the president says he wants this by October, what do you think about that?
Well, he's learned that if you delay it, the forces for stopping it become stronger and stronger. It's what happened with President Clinton. President Clinton had every bit as large a mandate as President Obama to do something. And when he made his speech and showed that health card that would be available for everybody, his popularity soared into the 90s. But then it took his team a year to come up with their 1,350-page detailed plan. And by that time, many of the assets that President Clinton brought to the table were being dissipated, particularly in his attempt to balance the budget. And so the forces for stopping health reform had sort of galvanized and were able to stop them. President Obama wants to make sure that doesn't happen.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the president's push to overhaul American health care. We're joined this hour by Julie Rovner, health policy correspondent for National Public Radio. Also by Stuart Altman, professor of national health policy and former health care advisor to Presidents Nixon and Clinton, as well as for Barack Obama's presidential campaign. Before we get to anything else, I'd like to hear from some of our listeners, some of America's healthcare consumers. Lisa's first on the line. She's in Newton, Massachusetts. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Hi, Jane.
Hi. What did you hear yesterday in President Obama's speech?
Well, from what I when I heard of it, I know he was facing a tough audience. Doctors, there are two of them in my family, so. And I don't know. My concern is that he'd be tough enough, really, on some of the interest groups, really, so that the patients get what they need. And I know that's going to take a lot of courage, I think, and political skill, and I hope he has those. I am disabled, and I just don't want them to make the same mistakes in the under 65 non-disabled, non-Medicare health reform that they did with Medicare Part D, Medicare Advantage. I think that it has to be a comprehensive plan, that if the government alternative should be a comprehensive plan that the sick and the healthy can join. I think that if people understood what regular Medicare was, I'm not saying there it doesn't have to be any restructuring, but that you can go to any doctor if you're in regular Medicare. And what happened with Part D was that the sickest, it didn't help them. It doesn't cover what they need, and I hope that doesn't happen, and I also hope that they will fix that.
Lisa, I hear your point. It's a good one. Julie Rovner, actually, let me pick up on Lisa's first point about the special interest groups. You know, pharmaceutical companies, device makers, all the rest. Are all sides gearing up for a fight on this?
Oh, yeah. You know, everybody is worried. You know, these groups have a lot of clout in Washington. Although I was talking to a lobbyist who were really an analyst, who talked about something called the 80-20 rule. And the problem is all of these interest groups have 80% of what's on the table they can live with, and 20% is anathema. And the problem is that 20% is different for each of these groups.
Right.
And that's really the issue here. I described it the last time around as everybody wanted to cut off, you know, one finger finger of this creature, and because of that, the entire thing bled to death, which is basically the same thing, that there's a problem. Everybody, you know, doesn't want one little piece of it, and that's really what you're looking at when you're trying to put together something this big, is that the one thing that somebody can't live with is something that another, you know, group really has
must
to have.
Take,
for instance, a mandate. For the insurance industry, they really want a mandate. They want everyone covered because that's how they can really spread the cost. But for the business community, the mandate is the one thing that they absolutely can't stand, to require businesses to contribute to part of the cost. So there's two things where you've got two major interest groups completely at odds with each other. For the doctors, they don't want to have their cost pressed down because they're afraid that, you know, they won't be able to afford to provide care. And yet for, you know, the public, that's the most important thing, is to have the cost brought down. So you've got a lot of interests who are really at odds with each other. And that's really the balancing act that lawmakers face in trying to put this whole thing together. We need to, as Peter Orszag likes to say, the president's budget director, bend the curve. You cannot have health care costs going up indefinitely that much faster than the rest of the economy. It will swamp the rest of the economy. But figuring out how to pick winners and losers is never an easy political activity.
So healthcare, what, 17% of the GDP now, up to 34% in what, another generation, Julie?
Yeah, pretty much.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Dr. Arnold Relman, he's former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, also emeritus professor of medicine and social medicine at the Harvard Medical School. He's author of the book, A Second Opinion, Rescuing America's Healthcare, and of the article in the current New York Review of Books, The Health Reform We Need and Are Not Getting. Dr. Arnold Relman, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Jane. Glad
nice
to be here.
You. Thank you, Doctor. As a doctor and former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, what did you hear in President Obama's speech yesterday?
Well, I heard a well-meaning president, a highly intelligent man, who I think thoroughly understands the problem, but is trying to do something that's quite impossible, namely, please everybody. As has already been pointed out, there are competing and conflicting special interests. And we have a president who wants to rule by consensus. And you can't do that with health care if you try to make a consensus of all the competing interests.
So what do you want him to do? What's the solution? You've written that part of it is to get rid of this for-profit aspect of health care. Is that the first point?
First of all, I think you need to diagnose what the real problem is. And I'm afraid that the administration at least has not made it clear that they understand the real problem. The real problem is that health care has become a business over the last several decades. And it's driven by the need to make profits for all the people who have a vested interest in the various businesses of health care. So we have to change that. And we have to recognize that the private insurance companies make no contribution of any social value at all. They are middlemen. They are parasites. They extract money from the system without giving the public anything commensurate in return. So we have to change the insurance system, and we also have to change the way we provide health care, change it from a business to a social service, which it should be.
Here's President Obama talking yesterday about the business of making money through costly care and it's not really why doctors go into medicine.
That's not why you became doctors. That's not why you put in all those hours in the anatomy suite or the OR. That's not what brings you back to a patient's bedside to check in or makes you call a loved one of a patient to say it'll be fine. You didn't enter this profession to be bean counters and paper pushers. You entered this profession to be healers. And that's what our healthcare system should let you be. That's what this healthcare system should let you be.
Stuart Altman, what's your response to that, to Dr. Relman, this aspect of getting rid of the for-profit aspect of healthcare?
Well, I think Dr. Relman represents what I would call the best of medicine and the best of the ethics of physicians. Please excuse me for being a little cynical. I don't think that there is a clear line where most physicians fall on either side. I think they're both. There's too much within the medical profession that is after making sure that they get a decent income, that they're protected, and to some it means doing more than a little. So I'm not criticizing them, but I think it's naive to believe that doctors are primarily interested in just taking care of people and they're not interested in their own economic well-being. They are the drivers of much of what we spend on health care. So this is a tricky business. If we allow them to do that, they will continue to do it. To try to stop that, they become a force to prevent change. So it's not unrealistic, but it's the reality.
Let's get another call in here. Dwayne is on the line from Underwood, Iowa. Dwayne, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hey, I'm an average consumer. I do work in the medical field, repairing x-ray equipment. And, yeah, I'm not real happy about my portion of my health insurance raising and what have you, but I understand that I have a personal responsibility. I find it a little unsettling that our president is wanting to take on control of our health care and eventually turn it into a socialistic. Listening to your, I think it was Mr. Altman there, I don't know that it has to be a total social service. I meet up with cardiologists, and they not only enjoy being the heroes every day, they enjoy being business people as well. And I think of myself, I enjoy repairing the cardiology equipment, but I also enjoy, you know, managing a household finances and doing lots of other things as well. So I just think that we are taking on too much.
So you see the big hand of government, Dwayne, looming over the system. Dr. Relman, do you agree? Is that what you worry about?
No, I absolutely disagree. I think there's a myth. What we need is a national system that allows the medical profession to do what it's trained to do, what it's supposed to do. Doctors are entitled to make a good living. And what we need is a new kind of organization. We need to give doctors incentives to practice together in groups with salaries instead of fee-for-service, the way they practice the Lahey Clinic or the Mayo Clinic or the Geisinger Clinic or Kaiser Permanente. And there are some doctors who won't like that, but my experience, and it's fairly wide and longstanding, my experience in talking to doctors all over the country in all sorts of different settings is that most physicians understand that practicing in groups for a salary will be a better way to take care of patients and will make them happier.
Let me say this, Julie Rovner. There are plenty of people like Dwayne who are concerned about the quote-unquote rationing of care, the big hand of government looming over the system, and it is very clear in my reading this week that the Obama message team is trying to control the language of this debate, telling Democrats on Capitol Hill to avoid using the phrase universal coverage because it's associated with some sort of socialist single-payer system. Instead, the approved language is guaranteed health care, a phrase that's less polarizing. Is that part of the administration's strategy here?
Yes, this is, you know, part of the problem, I think, with letting sort of Congress have its way with this is that there's so much in this debate that is undefined still, that you're seeing a lot of rhetorical wars. And then, you know, that this morning we had a piece where, you know, the Republicans are required to use the phrase government run rather than public option. And I think that both sides are getting a little bit extreme in what's being talked about, really, what's under discussion is having a public option that it is as yet undefined. It might be a Medicare-like system that the government would both run and decide how to pay, or it might be something where the government would just kind of provide the money and a state would run it, or it might be something like these co-ops that Senator Conrad is talking about. But regardless of what it would simply be one option for people to choose from among a group of private plans. And in fact, HHS Secretary Sebelius, you know, pointed out that single payer, as Dr. Relman is talking about it, is really not on the table, and that has all the people who would like there to be a fully government finance system furious that's not on the table. So all these people who are talking about government-run, socialized medicine, government rationing are really sort of not, I think, scared for nothing, because that's really not under discussion, to the extreme irritation of the people who would like that.
Stuart Altman?
I think that's a little unfair, or what's really happening out there. I think the people who originally advocated the public plan really did know what they wanted, and it really was a Medicare-type plan. They hoped to do two things. One, they so-called keep the insurance industry honest, but really what they were talking about is also using the power of government to sort of get rates down and therefore control costs. And, buy everything that Dr. Roman said. I mean, what he's talking about makes a lot of sense in terms of the payment. But there's no question that the people who really advocated this wanted that. Now, they're being forced to back away from it because the counter pressures are. And now we're coming into this world where it's unclear what they're talking about, but then it becomes unclear why they're doing it.
Here he is himself yesterday making the point that a single-payer system is not on the table.
Let me also address a illegitimate concern that's being put forward by those who are claiming that a public option is somehow a Trojan horse for a single-payer system. Now, I'll be honest. There are countries where a single-payer system works pretty well. But I believe, and I've taken some flack from members of my own party for this belief, that it's important for our reform efforts to build on our traditions here in the United States. So, when you hear the naysayers claim that I'm trying to bring about government-run health care, know this, they're not telling the truth.
Dr. Relman, the AMA has made it clear the public health insurance plan will be a major sticking point here.
Yes, they have. I think they're wrong. And the AMA is not a monolith, by the way. The position taken in public is the decision made by the leadership. Nobody's taken a poll of what the members believe. And there have been polls of what doctors in general, in and out of the AMA, think. And the latest poll showed that a majority of physicians believe that there should be some sort of national health insurance plan. That's a fact. And the percentage is growing, and the majority of the public believe it. So when we talk about what we can do in the face of the private special interests, we have to ask ourselves, what is the most important special interest in the United States? It's the interest of the people, and the people want a single universal health care system. That's what they want.
Let's bring another listener into the conversation before the break here. Ginger, she's in Holliston, Massachusetts. Ginger, welcome. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. I only have about a minute before the break. Make it quick, if you would, please.
Okay. Yeah, hi. I wanted to make a comment ask if you could please discuss about the HMO system.
Okay.
As much as I love my $5 copay, I think that a lot of parents really abuse the system by taking their kids for every little scratch and scrape to the emergency room, to the doctor, and consequently driving the cost of health care up.
Mm. All right, Ginger, thank you. Let's see, who could speak to that? Mr. Altman?
If you go back to this, Stuart Altman,
yes.
If you go back to the original concept of the HMO, which came out of the Kaiser Permanente plan, it was, in fact, to do that, that the system would deal with the worried well by developing plans that were less expensive, and that the system would be better served by not putting patients in financial risk, but deal with it. What's happened is that the HMO has morphed from that, where we don't have enough of these so-called different forms of delivery system for the worried well, which is what she's talking about. But the HMO concept really said, okay, this is what we're going to give you. You can do that, but we're not necessarily going to have you see a doctor. We're going to have you see somebody else if you're the worried well, and we'll focus our attention on those that really need the care. So your caller is not wrong, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. That isn't where our money is. That is really where our high costs are.
We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about President Obama's push to reform the nation's health care. Is it feasible? Is it the right plan? We're joined this hour by Julie Rovner, health policy correspondent for National Public Radio, and by Stuart Altman, professor of national health policy and former health care advisor to Presidents Nixon and Clinton, as well as for Barack Obama's presidential campaign. And we're joined by Dr. Arnold Relman, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, emeritus professor of medicine and social medicine at the Harvard Medical School, and author of the article in the current New York Review of Books, The Health Reform We Need and Are Not Getting. I have so many calls lined up here. I want to get to a few of them. Jane is on the line first. She's in Nashville. Jane, welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have two problems with Obama's push for health care reform.
Okay.
One is that I believe that you can have a uniquely American single-payer system. We don't have to have state-run hospitals and have our doctors be state employees. We can have them have privately run hospitals and doctor clinics and yet have a single-payer system, which I believe is the only financially viable way to have good health care for all Americans, because where the money is to pay for that is in the obscene profits and the ridiculous salaries of the insurance companies and the rest of the health care industry.
Is there anything that worries you in the Obama plan or the Obama speech from yesterday?
My second problem with his push is that I think he's going about negotiating all wrong. When you go into negotiations, you ask for what you really want or even a little more. You don't go in compromising in the beginning. And I think it's just a very bad tactical error for him to go in reassuring the insurance companies and reassuring the healthcare corporations that they're not threatened and getting them at the table and trying to exclude the single-payer advocates from the table and from the discussion and trying to cut that off at the pass. I think he needs us. He needs us to balance the tremendous weight and propaganda arm of the healthcare industry and all its money that it's spending on television. He needs people to listen to single-payer advocates to say that's really what we need. And then in the end, there will be some kind of compromise.
All right, Jane, thank you so much. Dr. Relman, you'd like a comment?
I think Jane hit it exactly right. What she said is absolutely true. There are two problems with our health care system. One is the for-profit private insurance industry, which, as I've said, is a parasitic middleman. Of course they're scared of a public option, and of course they're right. A public option would ultimately put them out of business. Why? Because a public option is much more efficient and much more attractive and would cost less money. The second problem is with the healthcare system itself, with the way we practice medicine. And Atul Gawande's article in The New Yorker a few weeks ago was a brilliant description of what's wrong with the way we practice medicine.
With a case study of El Paso, Texas.
No, of McAllen, Texas.
McAllen, Texas,
yeah,
that's right.
McAllen, Texas is the second most expensive town in the country as far as Medicare expenditures are concerned. And he went down there to find out why. And what he found out is something that could have been predicted from what we know. First of all, both of the hospitals, the only two hospitals in the town, one of them is a for-profit, investor-owned, publicly held hospital, and the second hospital is owned by doctors who are the investors. So neither hospital has a primary responsibility to the community. Both hospitals are businesses trying to maximize income. Furthermore, specialists dominate the system in McAllen. Primary care doesn't have a chance. What we need is to reorganize the delivery system. Doctors can happily and productively practice in groups, paid a salary, the way they do at the Mayo Clinic, or the way they do in the Lahey Clinic, the way they do in Geisinger or Kaiser Permanente. And the care is excellent, and patients love it. Mm. Patients can choose their doctor, choose what group they want, and the doctors can practice much better, more efficient medicine. Mm.
Julie Rovner, what about Jane's first point about the way President Obama is going about this, negotiating what she says all the wrong things right out of the gate? What's your take on that?
Well, I'm not going to second guess the president's negotiating techniques, but I would point out that in 1993, when the Clintons went out and kind of demonized certainly the insurance industry and the drug industry particularly, and that certainly didn't turn out well. So I think the object here has been to keep the special interests at the table. And the other thing is to keep certainly Congress in the driver's seat, if you will, rather than try to go off, as you know, Stuart Altman said, and have the administration try to write all of this and then present it to Congress as a fait accompli, say to Congress, this is really, you know, your effort, and we, the administration, are going to be here to advise you and to tell you what it is that, you know, that we think we would like. And I think that the administration is actually doing a fairly good job at trying to balance all of those things. Now, whether they're, you know, giving away too much in the beginning is hard to say. I think we'll know at the end whether they're, you know, if there's a bill, then who's going to second guess how they've done it. But I think also it should be pointed out that the caller made a very important point about single payers, that people misunderstand what it is. They talk about Canada and they talk about England as if those are the same thing, and they're fundamentally different systems. Single payer is much more like Canada, which is much more like Medicare. Single payer simply means that the government does the financing of the system through taxes, and indeed there would be no need for private insurance anymore. But it doesn't mean that the government runs the system, that it owns the hospitals, that it pays the doctors. It pays the doctors in the sense of it gives them, it pays their fees. But the doctors are still private. The hospitals are still private. Medicare is still voluntary. Basically, almost all doctors and virtually all hospitals take it because it's such a large part of the system. But it's not like in England where they really do have a government-run system where the government controls everything. So, it is very fundamentally different. And that, in fact, when you talk about single payer, you're talking much more about Medicare. The VA is much more like England where everything is really government-run.
So, Stuart Altman, can you, to the caller's point, Jane's point, can you have a uniquely American single payer system?
Well, you could, and clearly Julie is not wrong. On the other hand, for those of us on Medicare, and I'm on Medicare, I now get $1.05 or $1.10 worth of health care, and my Medicare program pays 90 or 80 cents because we average it out between what Medicare pays and what the private insurance pays. If everybody was on Medicare or on a single payer, while it is, Julie's absolutely correct, it doesn't mean they have to work for the government, I do think we would have to realize that there will be less money flowing into the doctors and hospitals. No question, we can save some of it, by getting rid of the insurance industry, but not all of it.
Dr. Elman, you're shaking your head. You want to jump in here?
Stuart, I usually agree with you, but I have to disagree here. There's plenty of money in the system. We don't need to spend more money on health care. We're wasting an enormous amount of money. We're wasting money by paying the huge overhead and the business costs and the profits to the private insurers, and we're wasting money in the public system because of the way we practice. Atul Gawande's article says it all. We practice a very expensive income-generating form of medicine. The evidence is very clear that if we practice good medicine, really good medicine, without worrying about how we make a profit, we would be able to save an enormous amount of money and afford the costs of covering everybody.
You're absolutely correct. I don't disagree with anything you say. However, Medicare is one of the leading culprits for leading to the McCallum problem. It is not a savior. I don't disagree with you, Arnold. You are so right. But just providing a single payer or a government system, not only would it not solve that problem, but could make it worse. So, yes, we have the ability to provide better care for actually less than we're spending. But quite frankly, I don't see a single payer as necessarily doing that. And the worst thing that would happen is we keep having all the bad sides of medical care, but just pay less for it. And then we will wind up with poor quality care.
Stuart, I believe that a universal system, an insurance system, really, we don't need insurance. We need universal coverage.
I agree.
A universal system plus reform of the medical delivery system. I agree, single payer or a universal insurance system alone won't do it. Medicare is going broke. We need to get rid of fee-for-service, and we need to have doctors practice in groups. That's the solution.
Let me get back to the phones now. In Brattleboro, Vermont, Scott is on the line. Been waiting a long time. Scott, thanks so much for calling. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi. I want to tell you guys, I'm a big supporter of what the president's doing. I'm a recent graduate from UVM, and I was called about a week after I graduated from college last year from Cigna, telling me I was going to lose my health insurance the next day. And I lost my health insurance, and for about 2 weeks I had no health care, and I signed up for this great program we have in Vermont, Catamount Health, and it's a state-run health insurance program designed for people, you know, who have very minimal income like me. And it's been an incredible program, and it's very similar to what the president's offering in terms of I only have to pay $10 copay whenever I go in to get a checkup, and it encourages healthy living, a healthy lifestyle, which, you know, I work out daily and I eat right. And I think it's just a great idea what the president's proposing. I don't think he's going to be able to get all of it, but it's just a great idea what he is proposing, because if you insure more people, you're most likely going to have less costs. I mean, I'm pretty sure that's the case. You guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but if you insure more people, then we're going to end up paying much less, you know, in the long run. So I think it's a great idea.
Scott's a supporter. Thank you. Mr. Altman, go ahead. Respond.
I just want to say your caller is absolutely correct. And what Vermont is doing and what we've done here in Massachusetts is the model. And I do believe much of what the president wants to do is along those lines. I happen to believe that this whole discussion about the public system is a distortion. Neither Vermont nor Massachusetts has a public plan, and both states are working. I think we can reform the insurance industry, get rid of those bad practices the way we've done it here in Massachusetts. I think the public plan is going to be a Trojan horse that everyone is going to attack. And what I fear is that much of what the president wants, which is very good, similar to what the caller talks about, could get lost because we fight over what that public plan is going to look like and where it's going to lead us.
Dr. Altman, quickly, before we go back to the phones.
The Massachusetts plan has increased coverage, but it's going broke. The future of the financial future of the Massachusetts plan is very bleak. Nobody in the state can imagine how we're going to pay for the rising cost of health care.
So this is not a panacea here. This is not necessarily the best model to be following.
But it is true that what Massachusetts did is to say we're going to cover everyone first and then we're going to deal with the cost issue. And I'm working very closely with a lot of people in Massachusetts to come up with a reasonable plan for lowering the cost of care. I agree. If we keep under the same trajectory, it will bankrupt the state. But I do believe the state of Massachusetts is going to come up with a plan, and we're so far ahead of the rest of the country. Our insurance, our uninsured rate is about a half or a quarter of what it is on average and for the rest of the country. We can be a model for the rest of the country.
Here's Lynn. She's calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Lynn, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm calling because I think that we need a national health plan. We have to look at the fact that most people are insured under their employer. And a lot of these people, once they, if they lose their job, they do not have insurance. For example, I know I don't, because I lost my job in February, and I no longer have insurance, and I can't afford a COBRA. And there are other people who are like me, and we have children, and maybe the children can because of different plans that the state have in contact with them, but sometimes the parents or the guardian, in my case the guardian, can't do that. I believe that we have to do something, because if we don't, we're going to let business tell us how our health plan is being run. We're complaining because we don't want the government in it, but we're actually letting business tell us that this is the way your health care has to be. And that is my that's what I think is happening. And I think that we need to do something for everyone, and not just for those who are fortunate enough to be able to work.
Afford it. Lynn, thank you. Dr. Relman?
The caller is absolutely right. Look, what we're going to get some sort of health reform out of the present Congress, and it's going to clearly expand coverage just the way the Massachusetts plan did. And then it's going to come up against the the brick wall of how do we pay for it. There is no proposal that's realistic, that's coming from the administration, that explains how we're going to pay for it. And so I think what we're going to do is we're going to take two steps. First, we'll expand coverage. Second, we're going to go increasingly broke. We're going to spend more and more money on health care, even more than we're spending now. And sometime in the not-too-distant future, we'll discover that the only way we can afford good universal coverage is to change the system, get rid of private insurance, and get rid of for-profit health care.
Julie Rovner, I'm going to give you the last word here. Put the president's October timeline into perspective for us. Where does all this stand, reform talk on Capitol Hill right now?
Well, I think that the debate that you just heard is pretty much a microcosm of the debate that's going on Capitol Hill, except that there's 535 of them instead of just two, plus all of the interest groups, plus all of the people who'd like to see single payer, plus all of the people for whom they're terrified that the government's going to take over the health care system, which gives you a pretty good idea of the of what Congress is up against and just the short legislative days that they have between now and October. Remember, they're out for most of the month of August and a week for a July 4th break. So it's an uphill fight. There's a lot to do. There's a lot of technical things about how to make this work, but I think everybody is says that they're pretty devoted to trying to make something happen. Everybody agrees that the system does not work well. That seems to be a pretty big consensus, and I think the interest groups even agree that business can't really afford this. The insurance industry isn't really working very well. Doctors are not very happy. So there will be some sort of effort. Whether there'll be something at the end, we'll see.
Many thanks to a terrific panel. We could go another hour here. So many issues. Julie Rovner, health policy correspondent for National Public Radio. Julie, thanks so much for your time.
You're so welcome.
Mr. Stuart Altman, a professor of national health policy at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. Mr. Altman, thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure.
And Dr. Arnold Relman, a former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, emeritus professor of medicine and social medicine at the Harvard Medical School, author of a couple of books at least. Doctor, thank you.
You're welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook, too, On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.